A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He and Hannah have been buying Euroboxes and hardware for their new place, which means they've been spending quality time in the Talpiot industrial zone. And he's struck by something that hits everyone the first time they walk into a proper industrial zone electrical supplier. Shelves floor to ceiling, parts you didn't know existed, prices maybe 30% lower than the city center hardware store, staff who actually know what a compression gland is, and you're standing there thinking, why is this stuff banished to a concrete wasteland 15 minutes from anything resembling a coffee shop? His question is whether the whole concept of the segregated industrial zone is an artifact of 20th century thinking about pollution and nuisance that no longer fits how light industry actually operates, and whether cities anywhere are starting to agree.
The short answer is yes, and the longer answer involves a Supreme Court case from 100 years ago that's still shaping where you can buy a junction box in Jerusalem. But let's start with the experience Daniel's describing, because it's real and it's weird. Talpiot has plumbing suppliers where you walk in and it's like a cathedral of brass fittings. Every diameter, every thread type, stuff that would take 3 weeks to ship from China, it's just sitting there on a shelf in a building with corrugated metal siding and no sidewalk.
The contrast is what makes it strange. You go from a city center hardware store that's basically a closet with some light bulbs and extension cords to this vast warehouse of specialized inventory, and the only thing separating them is a zoning designation drawn on a map in the 1960s. The closet gets to be on Jaffa Street. The warehouse has to be somewhere you can't walk to.
So let's start with the obvious question. Why do these places exist at all? Why did cities decide that industry needed its own zone, physically separated from where people live and shop?
I think most people's instinct, like Daniel's, is that it's about pollution. Smoke, noise, heavy trucks, chemical smells. You don't want a tannery next to your apartment.
That's part of it, but it's not the whole story. To understand why industrial zones are the way they are, we need to go back to the early 20th century, when cities first started drawing lines on maps separating where you could live from where you could work. The pivotal moment is a U.S. Supreme Court case called Euclid v. Ambler, decided in 1926. The village of Euclid, Ohio, and yes, that's where the term Euclidean zoning comes from, it's not a geometry reference.
I genuinely always assumed it was geometry, like rectilinear divisions of space.
Most people do. But no, it's named after a suburb of Cleveland. Euclid had passed a zoning ordinance that divided the village into districts, residential, commercial, industrial, and severely restricted what you could build in each one. The Ambler Realty Company owned a parcel of land that got zoned in a way that prevented them from developing it for industry, and they sued, arguing the ordinance was an unconstitutional taking of their property.
The Supreme Court said no, the village can do this.
The court ruled 6-3 that zoning ordinances are a valid exercise of police power, the government's authority to protect public health, safety, and welfare. The key logic was that an apartment building in an industrial district would be like a pig in the parlor. That's an actual quote from the opinion. The idea was that different land uses are inherently incompatible, and keeping them apart protects property values and public health.
A pig in the parlor. So the entire global framework for where you can buy a light switch starts with a metaphor about farm animals in a drawing room.
It really does. And the thing is, for heavy industry in the 1920s, the logic made sense. You had steel mills, slaughterhouses, chemical plants. These were dangerous and unpleasant neighbors. The problem is that the zoning framework never really distinguished between a Pittsburgh steel mill and a wholesale electrical supplier. They both got classified as industrial, and they both got pushed to the periphery.
How did this framework land in what was then British Mandate Palestine, and eventually become Israel's system?
The British imported their own town planning principles, which were heavily influenced by the Garden City movement, Ebenezer Howard's idea of separating residential areas from industrial ones with greenbelts. The 1932 Town and Country Planning Act in Britain was the template. In Mandate Palestine, the British applied similar principles, especially in new neighborhoods. After 1948, Israel inherited that framework and eventually codified it in the Planning and Building Law of 1965, which is still the statutory basis for land use planning in Israel today.
That law created the rigid separation we're living with. Residential here, commercial there, industrial, somewhere else entirely.
And here's where Talpiot gets interesting. Talpiot was actually established in the 1920s as a mixed neighborhood. It had residential buildings, some commerce, and it was meant to be a kind of garden suburb of Jerusalem. But by the 1960s, as Jerusalem expanded and the planning framework hardened, Talpiot got rezoned as an industrial zone. Some residential buildings remained, they were grandfathered in, but the area's official identity shifted. Today, it's this strange hybrid, light industry, wholesalers, retail showrooms, auto repair shops, all mixed in with a few remaining apartment buildings. It's a living example of zoning drift.
The businesses Daniel's talking about. The electrical suppliers, the plumbing wholesalers, the hardware stores with 10 times the inventory. They're not really industrial in the smoke and noise sense. They're retail businesses that happen to sell to contractors.
That's the key distinction. The economic logic of an industrial zone is about concentrating B2B supply chains, wholesalers, distributors, fabricators, near each other for logistical efficiency. If you're a contractor doing a renovation, you can hit the plumbing supplier, the electrical supplier, and the tile warehouse all in one trip, load up your truck, and get back to the job site. The retail-facing spillover, the DIY customer on a Friday morning, that's almost an afterthought. These businesses are optimized for contractor access, not consumer convenience.
Which is why they're in places with wide roads, loading docks, and absolutely no aesthetic ambition whatsoever.
That optimization works for the contractor. But for the person who just needs a specific pipe fitting for their apartment, it means a 20-minute drive to a place with no bus service, navigating past forklifts, and hoping the guy at the counter is in a good mood.
I've been that person. The guy at the counter is never in a good mood.
He's not there to be in a good mood. He's there to sell 500 of those fittings to a contractor who's going to buy another 500 next week. You, with your single fitting, are an interruption.
Which brings us back to Daniel's core question. If the business is quiet, clean, and sells things that ordinary people need, does it actually need to be in the industrial zone? Or is it there because the zoning code from 1965 has no category for retail that looks industrial but isn't?
This is where the noise and pollution assumption gets really interesting, because it's increasingly outdated. Modern light manufacturing, CNC machining, laser cutting, 3D printing, electronics assembly, even small-scale food production, generates a fraction of the external nuisance that a 1970s metal stamping plant produced. A CNC router in an enclosure is quieter than the ventilation system of a restaurant, yet the zoning classifications haven't caught up. A busy restaurant with a noisy kitchen and late-night crowds can sit in a residential neighborhood under commercial zoning, but a silent 3D printing workshop making custom parts gets classified as industrial and pushed to the edge of town.
The restaurant is a better neighbor than the print shop, but the zoning code thinks the opposite.
And that's the mismatch Daniel is sensing. The zoning code was written for a world of smokestacks and heavy truck traffic, and it's being applied to a world of laser cutters and Eurobox logistics.
That's how we got here. But the interesting question is whether we're stuck with this model, or whether cities are starting to rethink it.
They are, and in some pretty creative ways. Let's start with the United States. Portland, Oregon has something called the Central East Side Industrial District, and it's one of the most interesting experiments in industrial land protection in the country. The city explicitly protects industrial land. It's not up for conversion to condos, but it allows complementary retail and office uses within the district. The idea is that you keep the plumbing wholesaler and the metal fabricator, but you also let in the coffee shop that serves their workers, the design studio that collaborates with the fabricator, the small retail showroom that sells the fabricator's products. It's industrial land that's porous to the city around it.
It's not mixed use in the sense of apartments above shops. It's mixed use within the industrial category itself.
And that's a really important distinction. Portland isn't saying, let's put housing in the industrial zone. They're saying, let's let industrial zones be more than just industrial. Let them have the amenities and complementary uses that make them functional urban places rather than isolated monocultures.
What about in Israel? Is anything shifting here?
There's actually significant movement. In 2024, the Israel Planning Administration published a draft reform to the National Outline Plan, that's TAMA-35, and it includes provisions for what they're calling mixed-use corridors. The idea is to allow commercial and light industrial uses along major transportation routes in residential areas. So instead of having to drive to Talpiot for your electrical supplies, you might find a supplier along a main artery that also has apartments and cafes. The reform is still under public comment as of early 2026, so it's not law yet, but it's the most significant opportunity in decades to reshape how industrial zones work in Israel.
Public comment means anyone can weigh in. That's actually actionable for listeners who care about this.
But before we get to the action items, let me talk about Tel Aviv, because Tel Aviv has been doing something fascinating that's essentially zoning reform from the bottom up. The Florentine neighborhood and the area around Shuk HaYir have seen spontaneous mixed-use development. Small metal workshops, textile studios, printing shops, all coexisting with apartments and cafes. This happened despite the zoning, not because of it. The zoning said these were residential areas, but workshops had been there for decades, and as the neighborhood gentrified, instead of pushing the workshops out, they kind of layered together.
The city didn't plan it, but it also didn't stop it.
Now the city is retroactively legalizing it through what they call renewal plans. They're essentially acknowledging that the mixed-use fabric that emerged organically is actually valuable. It creates a more interesting, economically diverse neighborhood than either pure residential or pure industrial zoning would have produced.
There's something almost accidentally brilliant about that. The metal worker is there. The textile printer is there. The cafe is there. The apartment is there. And instead of saying this is a violation, everyone go to your designated zones, the city is saying, actually, this works, let's make it legal.
It works in part because the businesses in Florentine are small scale. We're talking about workshops with 3 or 4 employees, not factories with 50 workers and daily truck deliveries. The scale matches the urban fabric.
Which is the real question for the kind of businesses Daniel is talking about in Talpiot. The electrical wholesaler with 10,000 SKUs and a loading dock, can that actually fit into a mixed-use corridor, or does it need infrastructure that only an industrial zone provides?
This is the counter-argument, and it's a serious one. Industrial zones serve a logistical function that can't easily be replicated on a high street. Truck access, loading docks, waste disposal, 24/7 operations. These are real requirements. A hardware store might be quiet once the merchandise is on the shelf, but getting it onto the shelf involves pallet deliveries, forklifts, and sometimes early morning or late night shipments. Mixed-use zones need to solve what planners call the last 50 meters problem, how goods get from truck to shelf without disrupting residential life.
You can't just plop a Talpiot-style wholesaler into a ground floor retail space on a residential street and call it a day.
Not without some design thinking. But this is where European cities have been innovating. Berlin and Vienna have created something called production zones, areas where the zoning requires ground floor commercial or light industrial use with residential above, but also mandates specific noise mitigation measures, limited truck delivery hours, and shared loading facilities that serve multiple businesses. The idea is that you design the building and the street to accommodate the logistics, rather than just banning the use entirely.
Shared loading facilities. So instead of every business having its own loading dock facing a residential street, there's a centralized delivery bay that's acoustically shielded and only operates during certain hours.
And Berlin has been doing this in neighborhoods like Schöneweide, where former industrial sites are being redeveloped as mixed-use districts that retain manufacturing and production uses. The city recognized that if they just converted everything to residential and office, they'd lose the economic diversity and the jobs that come with light industry. So they created a framework that lets production stay, but in a way that's compatible with urban life.
That's the model that seems most promising for Israel's dense urban fabric. We're not talking about bringing a cement plant into the city center. We're talking about the kind of businesses Daniel is describing. Electrical suppliers, plumbing wholesalers, hardware stores that are already quiet at the point of sale and whose logistics can be managed with some reasonable constraints.
There's an economic argument here that's worth making explicit. A 2025 study by the Israel Democracy Institute found that industrial zone retail, hardware, electrical, plumbing, is on average 22% cheaper than equivalent city center stores. That's a real savings. But the study also found that the travel cost and time for consumers offsets much of that saving. If you have to drive 20 minutes each way, your time and fuel eat into the discount. Mixed-use zoning could capture the price benefit without the accessibility penalty.
The 22% savings that currently requires a car and a free morning could become a 15% savings you can access on foot. That's a net win for consumers, even if the absolute discount is smaller.
It's a win for the businesses, too, because they'd get foot traffic from people who currently just order from AliExpress rather than make the trek to Talpiot.
Daniel mentioned that specifically. The weird parts he gave up trying to find locally and ordered from China instead. Those parts were probably sitting on a shelf in Talpiot the whole time.
They almost certainly were. And that's the market signal Daniel is picking up on. The fact that these businesses thrive despite being inconveniently located means there's unmet demand for their goods in city centers. If a hardware store in Talpiot can survive serving contractors during the week and the occasional determined DIYer on Friday, imagine what it could do if it were accessible to every apartment dweller who needs a replacement part and doesn't want to wait 3 weeks for shipping.
What does this mean for someone who just wants to buy a weird pipe fitting without driving 20 minutes to an industrial zone?
In the short term, not much has changed. You're still driving to Talpiot. But the policy landscape is shifting in a way that could actually reshape where these businesses locate over the next decade. The TOMA 35 reform in Israel is the big one to watch. If the mixed-use corridor provisions survive the public comment period and get implemented, we could start seeing electrical suppliers and hardware stores opening locations along major urban arteries, places that are accessible by public transit and integrated into the fabric of the city rather than exiled to the periphery.
For listeners who want to push on this, the public comment period is still open. Individuals and local businesses can submit feedback advocating for mixed-use provisions in their neighborhoods. This isn't one of those abstract policy processes where citizen input goes into a black hole. Planning reforms at this level actually do get shaped by public comment, because the planning administration needs to know what communities will accept.
There's also a practical action that's available right now, which is simply changing your shopping habits. Next time you need a specialty part, check whether an industrial zone supplier has it before ordering from AliExpress. You might pay a bit more than the Chinese price, but you'll be supporting a local business that's already fighting against the friction of bad zoning. And every purchase is a data point. It tells the market that there's demand for these goods locally, which makes the case for urban locations stronger.
The deeper lesson here is that zoning is not a neutral technical tool. It encodes assumptions about what kinds of activities belong where, and those assumptions can become outdated faster than the zoning code gets updated. The question Daniel is asking, does this really need to be in the industrial zone, is worth asking about every business you encounter there. The furniture showroom, the lighting supplier, the tile warehouse, the kitchen cabinet fabricator. How many of these could function perfectly well on a high street, with some modest design accommodations?
As manufacturing technology continues to evolve, the distinction between industrial and commercial is going to get even blurrier. We're already seeing the emergence of microfactories, small-scale production facilities that use 3D printing, CNC machining, and automated assembly to make custom parts on demand. A storefront that 3D prints custom plumbing adapters while you wait is both a factory and a shop. Does that go in the industrial zone or the commercial zone? The zoning code doesn't have an answer because the category didn't exist when the code was written.
Which is where I think this is ultimately heading. The neat separation between residential, commercial, and industrial that the Supreme Court blessed in 1926 was always a bit of a fiction. Real cities have always been messier than that. But it was a useful fiction when industry meant smokestacks and commercial meant shop fronts, and the two looked nothing alike. Now that light industry looks increasingly like a quiet word shop or even a retail store, the fiction is breaking down.
The cities that are adapting fastest, Portland, Berlin, Vienna, even Tel Aviv in its messy bottom-up way, are the ones that are designing for the messiness rather than trying to impose a clean separation that no longer reflects reality.
The next time you're in an industrial zone, Look around and ask yourself which of these businesses could work on a high street. The answer might tell you something about how your city should be changing.
If you're in Talpiot, maybe pick up a Eurobox while you're there. Daniel would approve.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early Renaissance, sailors visiting the Comoros Islands reported that locals kept a species of small lemur as household companions, feeding them a diet of fermented coconut milk and believing the animals could detect spoiled fish before humans could smell it.
Fermented coconut milk. For a lemur.
That lemur had a better diet than most sailors.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, tell someone who's ever driven 20 minutes to buy a single pipe fitting. They'll feel seen. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com.
I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Pobbleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.